Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, we're going to be talking with a nationally known geriatrician, Dr. Greg Warshaw, about caring for an aging America. And this applies to those of you who are older, but to those of us who have parents who are aging as well.
Yeah, a critically important topic. And we're also going to be talking about research that matters about fast food and heart attacks, zinc in kids, videos of self-injury, and fake smiles. Lots of important research, Christy.
They are. So the first one is, Adam, if you had a heart attack, would you cut down on eating fast food?
Well, I know after my dad had a heart attack many, many years ago, the first thing my mom said is, we're going to have to cut down on the fast food. So I do know that she had that conversation with him, and they did cut down on it.
Well, this is a study looking at this very question. Of nearly 2,500 heart attack patients that were studied, they found out and surveyed them how many people were sort of heavy fast food eaters that ate at least once a week or more at a fast food restaurant, and then followed them over time after their heart attack to see how many of them were still doing that 6 months afterwards.
Yeah, this was in the American Journal of Cardiology, and of the nearly 2,500 heart attack patients that they followed, 36% while they were hospitalized said they had eaten fast food a lot in that last month. And then when they came back 6 months later, about 20% of the total said that they were still eating fast food every week, or 500 of the 2,500 patients.
Yeah. So, I mean, out of that group that were already eating a lot of fast food, I mean, almost 60% of them were still eating a lot of fast food after their heart attack. Now, that tended to be younger people, male people who were working, and those who didn't have quite as much education. But it's still sort of concerning. Some might argue that the fast food restaurants are offering a few healthier options, and we don't know what they chose.
Yeah, and I think that the picture is probably a little better than it's pointed out here. First off, I know to make a behavior change is huge, and I sometimes worry that we give people too much of an ultimatum here. And the fast food industry is responding to consumer preferences by trying to put some healthier items on the menu. So I think you can get healthy items at most of the fast food. And what is fast food? Could it be a Chinese restaurant? Japanese restaurant?
Right.
Anything you pick up?
Well, and it certainly depends on what you're choosing, but typically fast food restaurants have more salt load and other things
right. That
could be hard for you.
And they did try to counsel these people. 9 out of 10 got counseling, but that didn't really change what they found. But, you know, Christy, we're going to have some great information up on our website after we're able to post this on our new research blog. So people who want to know a little bit more about this study and also can find out more information about maybe fast food that's healthy, they can go to our website.
Yep. Okay, let's do the next one. Now, this is more of a global health question. For kids in poverty across the world, we know that iron and zinc are important to everyone's brain development as children, and that children in developing nations are at risk of not getting zinc and iron in their diets.
Yeah, we also know that iron is linked to all kinds of behavioral problems. If you don't have sufficient iron, you can have attention deficit disorder, brain development, lots of behavioral things. So it's really important. But the question is, can a supplement started when you're young actually prevent some of these problems from happening?
So they looked at 569-year-olds in Thailand who, when they were babies, had been randomly assigned. Some of them got supplements of iron and zinc, and some of them just got like a sugar pill. And they followed them over time, over 9 years, and did some testing to see if the ones who got the supplements did better with IQ, memory, attention, and school performance.
Yeah, and this research that was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition showed that there really wasn't a difference in their outcome when they followed them later on. But I think there's a caveat here. They only got it for 6 months, very, very early on. And so and there weren't many kids who actually were iron deficient.
Right. And there were other studies showing some benefit. So there was a study in Nepal that of looking at pregnant women. And when they took iron and folic acid during pregnancy, their kids did better on some tests of intelligence and fine motor skills. So I think the jury's still out.
About whether supplement is needed, but the jury is certainly real clear. I think Chris and I both can say, if you're iron deficient or if your child's iron deficient and maybe needs to be tested to see, a supplement then is absolutely necessary.
Absolutely. And zinc can help prevent diarrhea, which is a problem in the developing world. So there are other reasons it may be beneficial.
And we can put some information on iron on our website as well.
We sure can.
To look there. What's next?
Okay, Adam, do you ever give a fake smile?
Is my smile right now, Christy? What about yours?
Is it fake?
Well, I think part of our smiles were a little bit fake, but in general, our listeners should know that Christy and I do smile a lot. We laugh a lot. We like
happy.
Each other, and we're generally happy. That's right. So our smiles are less fake. But why would it matter?
Well, it might be tied to your health. So this was a study in the Academy of Management Journal.
Interesting journal. Okay.
Yeah, they were examining what happened when bus drivers engaged in fake smiling and when they had engaged in what they call deep acting, when they generally made happy smiles through positive thoughts when they encounter people at work.
Yeah, they found that on the days when they had these kind of fake smiles that the people who they were following, these bus drivers, had tended to have worse mood and they tended to kind of withdraw from the work. I guess maybe they're trying to get rid of some of these negative thoughts, but it was kind of persistent.
Yeah, and women were more affected by this than men. And the author suspected that maybe that had something to do with our cultural norms about us needing to be more emotionally expressive as women and then having to fake that smile might make it harder. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think it raises lots of interesting questions. You know, when you come into the doctor's office, are you greeted by a smile? And can you really fake that? Or, you know, you don't want to, but, you know, we try to encourage all of our people who interact with patients to be friendly, happy, smiling. But if you don't feel like it, can you really do it?
Right. And maybe if you accompany that smile with positive thoughts of really thoughts of wellness, that could have a very positive effect. So,
yeah, I know that I had a cousin recently who's autistic. Two of them, actually, and went to different events in their families. And one of them had a very, very difficult time because of their autism and smiling and is very withdrawn. The other one was smiles all the time and people are just drawn in.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that there's this real need for us all to figure out how to have really authentic smiles mm-hmm. in our lives more often.
Absolutely.
Very important research. What's our last one?
This is a little scary to me. This is about YouTube videos of self-injury. So people who perform what's called cutting, where sometimes in teenagers and other people may injure themselves.
Burning, hitting, biting, picking.
And they might do it not necessarily to try to kill themselves, but just to cause themselves injury. It's tied with some mental health problems, as you might imagine. But there are a lot of videos out there on YouTube that anyone can find that may make it look kind of cool to do this.
Yeah, this was in the journal Pediatrics, and these researchers looked at depictions of this cutting behavior on YouTube and found that these videos were selected as favorites more than 12,000 times. And then they looked at to what extent did people who viewed these give comments that were negative, positive, or neutral.
And it was pretty phenomenal for me to say only about 1 in 4 of the 100 most viewed videos on YouTube had any clear message against self-injury. And a number of them really made it seem normal.
Yeah,
or attractive.
I think that this is important research, something I hadn't really thought about. It's, again, we need to be much more aware of this YouTube, the social media connection. And as a parent, if you have a child that's exhibiting any form of cutting behavior, look and see what websites they're looking at. That's a take-home message for me.
Well, and a take-home message to pay attention to what your child is looking at on the computer for all of our parents.
Yeah, and we'll put some information, again, a good resource to go to for patient education about the prevention of these sorts of cutting and self-inflicting behaviors on our website.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We've talked a little bit about YouTube videos on self-injury. About
this fake smile, but we're going to make it real.
About supplementing for kids in poverty.
And fast food after a heart attack. Make sure it's a healthy choice and or cut down.
So we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Greg Warshaw about caring for an aging America. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking about caring for an aging America. Are we prepared? What do you think, Christy?
Gosh, well, the statistics would say that we've got a lot of work to do to become prepared, but I'm excited to have a chance to have this conversation today.
What kind of statistics? Just give me one.
Pretty impressive. So, I mean, this year, 2011, marks the year that the first wave of the 76 million baby boomers will reach the age of 65, making them eligible for Medicare. So we're just, I mean, this is the first wave. So just thinking about how many doctors we have to care for them is an important question.
Well, we're really fortunate then to have a wonderful guest today who's actually a visiting Huntley lecturer at the UNC Department of Family Medicine. Who do we have today?
We'd like to welcome Dr. Greg Warshaw, who is Professor of Family and Community Medicine and the Simmons Professor of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Warshaw.
It's great to be here.
Let me just ask a question, Dr. Warshaw. You know, Christy and I, we're both practicing family physicians. We both care for a good bit of geriatric patients. But I don't think we came into family medicine thinking, oh, we're going to care for lots of family geriatric patients. At what point in time in your career did you know that geriatrics was going to be a significant part of your career as a family physician? How did that happen?
It can be a long story, but I'll make it a little bit briefer than it actually is. I entered a residency program in the mid-70s, and our program director was actually up the street in Durham, was a visionary. And he had three themes that he really emphasized in the program, and one of them was geriatric medicine. So I got it right from the beginning in training. And since there were no U.S.-trained geriatricians to speak of at that time, he went around and found Scottish geriatricians to come and spend a year in our department. And we had two years when I was in residency, we had two visiting professors for a year each who were experienced Scottish geriatricians. And I understood what geriatrics was after I finished my residency.
Which was so, what?
Well, what I figured out was that it involved the same type of clinical practice that I was learning about in family medicine. It was very community-focused. It was very family-focused. But what the Scottish geriatricians knew is they just knew a whole lot more about older people than I had learned in my residency. They knew about the kinds of problems that frequently occur in older people. For example, I had never been taught anything in my training about how to address an older person who's having trouble with falling or gait problems. Didn't know anything about it. They were experts on that. They knew all about it.
So let's talk a little bit about this word geriatrician, because I don't know that everyone might know exactly what it means to be a geriatrician as opposed to a primary care doctor who takes care of older people. Explain to us what the difference is.
As well as the term geriatric, both those terms. Who's geriatric and what's a geriatrician?
They're not new terms. Formation of the term geriatric medicine goes back early into the 20th century, but it was really operationalized by, once again, in Great Britain, by some really remarkable early internists, family doctors who were interested in the care of older people. One woman who I've read quite a bit of is a woman named Marjorie Warren, who was a physician in Britain after the war, World War II. Who really helped form geriatric medicine within the National Health Service in Britain. And her vision was that older people were not receiving the best care. And the reason they weren't receiving the best care is that medical treatments that you would use for a middle-aged person didn't always work well in older people. and it was built on the same concepts that developed pediatrics.
Like what type of procedure would might come to mind?
So, well, for example, it was a common practice, still does occur a little bit too much today, to take older people when they're sick and put them to bed and nurse them, basically treat them kindly and not make them get out of bed too much and sort of let them rest until they felt better. Marjorie Warren would walk around hospitals in Great Britain and see people lying in bed for 3 or 4 weeks and realize that these people were dying in these beds and that what they really need to do is to get out of bed. It was kind of a tough love approach, but she had understood the concept of the way your muscles weaken if you're just lying around. And although people were trying to be helpful, they were actually doing the exact wrong thing for these older patients.
So people who use the term geriatrician for themselves are people who've done additional training, research, have more of an expertise in caring for older adults? Or how do you frame it?
In the United States, all the geriatricians are family physicians or general internists who have gone on to do additional training. And usually it's 1 or 2 years of additional training. It's similar to a subspecialty. It's in England, it's a separate specialty, like pediatrics. In the United States, it's really a subspecialty of family medicine and internal medicine. And there's relatively few geriatricians in the United States compared to the large number of family doctors and internists. So when we think about the future care of older people, particularly the future general care, primary care of older adults in the United States, we have to be thinking about a workforce that includes geriatricians, family doctors, general internists, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, anybody willing to help.
So there is sort of a movement, as our culture and our society is very specialty driven, of people who feel like they should only, if they're older, that their parent or grandparent should be seeing a geriatrician, but the numbers don't add up, right?
Yeah, it won't, at this point, it's not possible for all older adults to seek care from a geriatrician. And that's why it's so important. One of the reasons I'm here visiting the Department of Family Medicine at UNC is to emphasize how important it is that all the residents and future doctors trained here learn how to take care of older people well, since they'll be spending most of their time doing that when they graduate.
Absolutely.
Well, isn't there also, I mean, there is a risk here that we move towards specialty care, and people think that at every age they have to see a specialist. So to me, there seems like there would be a tension here between training people who are competent to care for people who are older versus having the title of a geriatrician. And as I get older, I wonder, do I want the family doctor or the internist who's followed me for 20 years, who continues to know me, versus the need to think I need to go see now another specialist? How do you address that tension?
It's a non-tension. It doesn't exist. It exists within professionals, but doesn't exist within patients. The only patients I see are people that are dissatisfied with the care they're receiving from their general physician. And generally, most physicians do a great job taking care of their older patients, and there's no need for my services.
So which patients then do you think need to actually, or maybe at risk or higher risk, and may need then this, because if there's only a limited number of geriatricians, they have to choose which patients they will see. How does that process occur?
The best way to think about it, and the way I think we're doing it now is still pretty primitive, is that in the future, the best care for older people will be in teams. Partnership teams that involve a primary care physician, like a family doctor, probably a nurse practitioner or a social worker who is helping that physician with the most complex older patients, and maybe a geriatrician who occasionally is available to consult with the nurse practitioner and the primary care physician. We're testing models like that around the country now. I'll be talking more about those on Wednesday when I give my lecture. But this type of team care is really what I think we're going to be heading for in the future.
Well, and that's the basis of the patient-centered medical home and so many things we're doing with people who have multiple chronic illnesses, that it really takes a village. You know, it takes the teamwork to be able to do it well.
The great thing about working with older adults and the fact that we have so many of them coming is that there's more work for more people than we possibly could ever complete. So there's just room for everybody in this goal of trying to provide older people with the best care we can.
Well, speaking of room for everyone, we need to take a short break and have some room. But we'll be right back because we really want to fill up this conversation with lots of nuances and things that I know Christy and I are interested in and hear your thoughts on. We're going to take a short break, but when we continue, we'll be with our guest, Dr. Greg Warshaw, about caring for an aging America. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with nationally known geriatrician Dr. Greg Warshaw about caring for an aging America, a little bit about the challenges that we have as primary care doctors to care for our patients as more of our population is older, and about the role of geriatricians and teamwork in working together to care for people.
And, you know, one of the questions that comes up as I go over the age of 50, like I did last year, Dr. Warshaw, is this question of, what is this term healthy aging, you know, versus chronic disease? You know, are they a dichotomy? Are we going to look forward to both of those things as we get older? How do you have that conversation with people?
Well, the Americans are aging and living longer, and a lot of Americans are quite healthy in their old age. But not everybody. And sometimes it's because of bad luck related to acquiring illnesses like arthritis or heart disease. But sometimes it's because people just haven't taken care of themselves when they were younger. They maybe smoked too much or drank too much or didn't exercise. And they just don't age as well as people that have managed to control some of those habits. I work a lot with people over 80. And I learn a lot about how to live a long, healthy life from talking to these over 80 people. They have been...
What kind of advice do they give?
They have been very far ahead of everybody else in terms of their fitness and exercise and avoiding drugs and alcohol and drinking moderately. And they just... And they're also very adaptable. I'm convinced that you can't really live a long, successful life if you're not used to change. Because you imagine, I mean, I just was talking to a patient recently on my unit whose brother and father died in the Russian Revolution. I mean, when you imagine what she's experienced during her lifetime, having come from Russia after that experience, and how she still survives today in Cincinnati, it's remarkable to me. It takes a certain personality to do that.
Well, and so much of caring for older individuals is hearing their stories and their hopes and their values to guide those decisions. I have an 82-year-old patient I just saw and was meeting with her family to start talking about her wishes for the end of life. And she's doing very well, had her first heart attack, but doing well. And it seemed the family was like, wait a minute, why are we talking about this? But are we supposed to help people age well and also have time to think about those things while they're healthy?
I think it's great that you brought that up when the person was otherwise not in an emergency or not in the hospital or not terribly ill. I find older patients are more likely to want to have those conversations than sometimes their children are. Mm-hmm. And so frequently I have with alert, healthy people, I'll usually have those conversations by myself with them and then maybe bring the family into it a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But a lot of older people are quite happy when their physician asks them what their wishes are for the future, what kind of care they want. My experience is that when people get into the 85, 90-year-old age range, they are much more interested in things that I can do to make their life of higher quality and allow them to be independent than to add a few months to their life. They've lived a long time. They've enjoyed their life. They're not really interested in things that you might live a few extra years with this. That's not as important to them as you can stay at home for the rest of your life if we do this.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about maintaining independence, and I think a fear for a lot of people is ending up in a nursing home. What are the tips or what are the conversations you have with a patient about this quality? You mentioned tips that you can give to maintain independence. Give us an example.
Well, in terms of general health, other than avoiding some bad habits and maintaining a reasonable weight, There is no fountain of youth that's more effective than fitness and exercise. And you can start that at any age. So you do not have to be an athlete. You do not have to have exercised a lot in your 50s or 60s. You can start when you're 70. But exercise is really critical to successful aging. It may not prolong somebody's life, but if they do become ill, they'll recover more quickly and more successfully. So it's a really valuable way to spend time as you get older, is to spend some time exercising. And exercise could be as simple as just taking a nice walk 3 or 4 times a week would be a great way to get started.
And what about, what do we know about strategies to keep people in their home versus needing to be in a nursing facility? Not that nursing facilities are all bad, but many of our patients really want to be home.
I think that in general, once again, to a certain extent, it has to do with circumstances and somebody's general health. When I give talks to older adults, I sometimes will tease them that the most important things they have as you get older are daughters and money. And I think that that help would keep you out of the nursing home more than anything else.
Not sons.
Sons are occasionally helpful.
Occasionally, Adam.
Son-in-law.
The youngest one, maybe.
But, the majority of people in nursing homes are women. And the reason they're in nursing homes more than men is because they outlive their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
When their husbands become ill, women take care of them. But most women don't have a live husband. So the other thing you can do is you can just marry a much younger man.
Well, I've done that, actually. That's going to go well.
That's a good idea.
Tell us one, taking care of people. We think of frequently the patient coming to the doctor, but I know I was trained and Christy was trained to do home visits on patients and to go to their homes. It seems as if that was a lost art, but we continue to train our learners. Is that viable, and is that an important part of care for older people from providers as we move forward into the 21st century?
I think we're going to see it become a much more important part of care. It has gone out of favor a bit. It became somewhat inefficient. People felt like it was going to take too much time for a busy doctor to go to somebody's home. Now we see it happening occasionally in special cases where somebody's unable to get out or there's a need to really assess what's going on in the home. But I think in the future, as we really try to create a health system that is less dependent on expensive settings like hospitals and emergency rooms, we'll see more and more care delivered in the community and in people's homes. And I think doctors will get back into doing that kind of care, along, once again, with the rest of the healthcare team, nurses and nurse practitioners. There'll be a team approach to providing home-based care.
And so you give this vision of the team-based care and real emphasis on primary care, and yet we already talked about this tension with so many people wanting to go to an orthopedic doctor for their knee problem and this specialist for this person, and sometimes the primary care doctor gets pushed out. As a system or as a nation, what do we need to do to really move forward to emphasize these things?
We certainly need to make access to general medical care easier and more accessible so that people will feel good about coming to a primary care doctor's office. I think there's certainly need for specialty care. My patients receive wonderful benefits from specialty care. But the family physician, general internist, geriatrician who's doing primary care, working with an older person, really has to stay engaged. I'm hoping that the electronic health record and ability to stay in closer touch with what's going on in your patient will help a bit. But I also think it's a matter of training and the family doctor asserting themselves or herself into the care of their patient and really being concerned about what happens when the patient goes somewhere else and getting that information and following up on it. I would say that in my practice, I spend a fair amount of my time explaining what happened at the specialist's office, mm-hmm. and talking about what we should do about it. I find that patients really need that generalist to sort it all out, because like you said, some patients may have 3 or 4 generalists.
Speaking of time, we're going to maybe just have time for just a couple final thoughts, but one of them I want to ask you about is this question of time. It seems to me that one of the great things that as we take care of older patients is we need more time in the clinical encounter. How does that work in your practice and in your advice of training new generations. How do you talk about the essence of time spent with the patient?
It's a challenge because I think people are aware that in family doctors' offices, things go pretty quickly nowadays. The appointments are 10 or 15 minutes long, and that's not always enough time to do all the things you need to do. I do see patients frequently, so I may not tell a patient come back in 3 weeks or 4 weeks. I may say, come back next week. We need to keep talking about this. I work, once again, in teams. I may have a nurse follow up after my visit. I have a physician assistant who I partner with who can follow up after the visit. So working in ways to make sure that the time is taken to get the kind of care that people need. And we do have problems in the way that's paid for now, and that's will have to get worked out if we're really going to do a good job caring for older people. But I'm convinced this is all going to occur in the future because we're just going to have to be more efficient to give people the care they need at a lower cost.
Well, and the sheer volume of people we need to take care of will force our hand to find ways to do it.
Absolutely. We've been talking with Dr. Greg Warshaw of the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine and the Huntley Lecturer at the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Dr. Warshaw.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also send us to comments on Facebook or calling us on Twitter or in our telephone number, 966-8081.
So we'd like to answer a few questions from our listeners that we have today.
Our very first house call.
I've heard that birth control is linked with breast cancer, and I was wondering if there was any truth to that and whether, if it is, there are certain birth controls that might be better than others.
Good question. Birth control pills and breast cancer, are some better than others? We have some research to answer that.
We do. Well, I'd say it's reassuring to know that there's, at least the data that we have right now with the research available, there's no overall increased cancer risk from taking the birth control pills. And there are some cancers that you have a decreased risk, like ovarian cancer, if you're on birth control. But there is some conflicting information about breast cancer.
Yeah, some studies show a little increased risk. Some show there's no increased risk. And so overall, there isn't any overall increased risk. And, you know, this is a pretty researched study area. There are 50,000 women in one study for 24 years in Great Britain. And if there is any increased risk, it's probably very, very, very small.
I do think if you're a person who has a real strong family history of breast cancer or you have one of those genes we talked about in a previous show.
BRCA1 and BRCA2, BRCA1 and BRCA2.
Yeah, we talked about that on a previous show. You could find it on our blog. But if you had one of those, then I'd say you'd want to have a more careful conversation
Absolutely.
With your physician
That's
about
a good
it.
Point. But if you're actually only on the progestin-only pill, there's no increased risk either. So hopefully that's useful, and let's go on to our very next house call.
This is a question related to my father. Do you recommend using low-dose aspirin for a patient who has congestive heart failure and is using Coumadin for atrial fibrillation?
Now, this is a very, very, very complicated question.
It is. I thought this was a pretty straightforward one. Uh-oh.
Well, I think it depends to me on the congestive heart failure and the other heart history.
With more history here. You're filling in between the lines.
I am, because if he's had heart attacks, and particularly if he has any stents in his heart, well, then there may be an indication to have both aspirin and Coumadin and Plavix as well, another blood thinner. But for most people... go ahead and you give your answer and then I'll fill in the rest of mine.
Well, I was just going to limit it to the first half of the question, which made it a little bit easier, which is the data on low dose aspirin for a patient who has congestive heart failure. Well, the safety data is kind of lacking overall, whereas, you know, the American College of Physicians has a policy statement from 2008 that recommends not doing it. A lot of folks would say there's not enough evidence for or against, but then you brought up some really good points, Christy.
And so for atrial fibrillation, where you have that funny heart rhythm and quiver in your heart. Now that, there's great data to say that being on Coumadin reduces your risk for stroke. There is risk with being on Coumadin that you could have, which is a blood thinner, that you could have bleeding from your colon, bleeding in your head if you had a big fall. So there are some risks to talk about with your doctor. But being on Coumadin and aspirin together dramatically increases your bleeding risk.
I think we both agree that this is probably not to be done. You're probably going to have increased risk of bleeding and hospitalization. A lot of other drug interactions. Complicated question, but a really good one.
Mm-hmm. And one you should talk to very specifically about your father's heart situation with your doctor to be sure that it's the right decision.
Okay, let's listen and see what our very next house call question is.
My question is, I was wondering why celiac disease is so much more prevalent in the populations now. Just why it's showing up more.
That is a wonderful question. Another good one.
And it's one that, I hadn't really appreciated, Christy, enough that, when I was in medical school, celiac disease is one of those things we read about, we studied, and I never saw. And then sometime over the last 10 or 15 years, I started hearing a lot about it.
Well, I think we should probably define it for our listeners. So celiac disease is a problem. It's an ongoing sort of long-term problem with absorption in your gut.
So sometimes called tropical sprue, right?
Or a sensitivity to gluten, mm-hmm. which is in wheat, barley, and rye, in foods that you eat. And so there are a lot of people who have lots of problems with belly pain or diarrhea, and then once they eliminate these things from their diet, find that they have less symptoms.
Yeah, and the question about why is it more prevalent now? Well, part of that is really how we've gone about diagnosing it. In the 1950s, we thought it was pretty rare, one out of maybe 5,000 to 6,000, but we didn't have the ability to diagnose it like we do now, and we have so much better ability to diagnose it now. So we say it's in every, one to every 400 or so, but that's in large part, I think, because we can diagnose it so much better.
I would say the same. Now that we have these easy tests to do.
You know what one of them's called, Christy? It has a fancy name called endomycial antibody testing, endomycial, also called silent celiacs. Like that term, silent celiacs.
Silent celiacs.
As compared to the classic celiacs, the way it used to present. Now we can maybe diagnose it much earlier and in all age populations, but predominantly from people from Northern European descent.
Well, and I got to tell you, it's an easy test to order. And so for people who have unexplained symptoms with their stomach, it's something that you can order and investigate.
Yeah. Is it expensive? Do you know?
I don't know.
I don't know either, but
I've
always assumed it's probably pretty expensive. So you can ask your doctor about it, but make sure that it may
make
get
sure your
paid
symptoms,
for.
Well, and you want to make sure your symptoms make sense with it, you know?
Yeah, maybe we can put up some information about this particular test
on
our website.
Blog.
We'll see what we can look into
idea.
It and find out. What's our very last house call?
What do you think about the new artificial sweetener, Truvia? Is it better than the others?
Ooh, good question. Excellent question. Thank you so much.
Well, and I'll be interested in what you found on this, Adam. But, Truvia, I think the thinking is that it is more natural because it comes from this plant called the stevia plant. And it's considered a natural sweetener instead of being something that we created in a laboratory.
Yeah. Also, the sweet leaf or the sugar leaf plant coming from South America that's been out there for a long time that most recently commercialized by some of the major soft drink companies. We won't mention their name, and you have to cut our tongues off to get it, but put into products to compete with those other sweeteners like Splenda and Equal, Sweet and Low. Those kind of things.
Yeah. And it's got like almost 10% of the sweetener market. So it's become very popular as a sugar substitute. In terms of is it safer or better or are there benefits over the others? And my take on this is that the jury's still out.
Yeah, I think so, too. The World Health Organization in 2006 said there was really no significant cancer-causing or heart problems significant. The toxicity does appear to be low. It's kind of got a longer duration, a slower onset than some of these other sweeteners. But I agree, Christy. I think the jury could still be out. And if you in some people, it could be maybe having a bad effect. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think we won't know until time, you know, we have time to look at these over time. But at this point, it seems to be safe, but I can't say it's more safe than the others.
Yeah, so again, this is a great question. Maybe we can try to find some comparative information between all of these different sweeteners, because it is a little confusing. But we know the food.
Which one do you take? If you have to choose at the table, Adam, which one do you choose?
I'm weird, Christy. I use unsweetened iced tea and unsweetened coffee. My children and my wife look at me with horror.
Well, I'm on the other extreme, but I choose Splenda only because I like the way it tastes and it feels like it's sort of natural.
Sucrotose. Splenda is sucrotose. So, well, you are a sweet person, and hopefully this we've given some answers here today about not only Truvia, but also about testing for celiac disease.
And a little bit about atrial fibrillation and aspirin versus Coumadin versus
probably
both.
Probably not both, for particularly for just heart failure. And then birth control, and probably safe to minimally increase risk, even if it's there, with breast cancer.
So thank you for calling us with questions. We want you to write us, call us, contact us, go to our blog.
Twitter us.
There's so many different. Tell us what you thought about the show. There's so many different ways to reach us. The phone number is 919-966-8081. Email is yourhealth@unc.edu. And the blog is yourhealthradio.org.
And we'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and we hope you enjoyed our guest today, the Huntley Lecturer, Dr. Greg Warshaw.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk with you again next week.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.